session on the working class politics, current situation sponsored largely by the Committee of Correspondence and Diplomacy and such. And if you don't, haven't heard of us, there's a basic brochure that you can pick up and learn about us. If you like what you read, you're welcome to join. If you just want to get on a list, I have a list here for you. Get your email addresses, we promise not to bombard you. My name is Carl Davidson. I'm one of the co-chairs of the Committee of Correspondence and Diplomacy. And also, one of the presenters, but not the first one. The first speaker we'll have will be Randy Shannon. Randy is one of our national committee members. He's also the treasurer of Beaufort County, Progressive Democrats of America. This is electoral group that we work with. This is Pat Fry. She's going to be our third speaker. And Pat works with the SEIU in New York City. And she's also one of the co-chairs of CCPS. So let's start with Randy.
Well, thank you for coming. And the title of this paper is Struggle for Full Employment. A strategy to defeat the neoliberal assault on the U.S. working class. Last night, Barbara Bowman, in her speech, closed by saying, "This is the time to sharpen our demands to build our culture. This is the way to find our resistance to this economic movement." I think that really came through clearly to me, and I hope this paper is a contribution to sharpening our demands and finding path to resistance to the current economic movement. At the Left Forum in New York a few months ago, I was at a workshop, David Kotz said that this crisis marked the end of the neoliberal social structure accumulation that was begun in the Reagan era. And I'm not sure if this is the end of that, but I think it's clear that there are two really powerful countervailing forces in the political sphere. One is the crisis, economic crisis of neoliberalism, and the other is the growing consciousness of electoral activity of the progressive majority, as we saw in the 2006-2008 elections, where people expressed a much more progressive outlook than we saw previously. I think that there are really two aspects of this economic crisis. The first is the financial crisis, which was immediately disposed of. And the second, more prolonged and widespread crisis is that of employment. And that is not the best. And if you watched the news yesterday, you saw that the Federal Reserve has a growing caucus of members who are talking about tightening interest rates, so that even in the deepest employment crisis in the past, the Great Depression, there's a considerable wing of the financial oligarchy that is talking about tightening interest rates to slow down that growth so that we don't have inflation. Of course, this is what my paper tries to address, in some sense, the need to change from social policies based on monetary concerns to ones based on human rights. And also, you saw in yesterday's news the employment report, which showed that in reality only 41,000 jobs were created by the private economy, and something like 320,000 jobs were created by the citizens. And this was even below the optimist expectations. So I think that as time passes on, people people are going to start to realize that this is a very long-term crisis. And I think that it's really important for the left and for CCDS to be strive to become a political voice of the left to talk about, you know, the deeper economic basis of the employment crisis and what the path is to sharpen our demands and find a way to move out of this situation. The paper starts off with the UN Declaration of Human Rights, which says that everyone has a right to work, to free choice of employment, to just and favorable conditions of work, and to protection against unemployment. And a few years ago, the United Nations countries agreed to a Millennium Program in which the right to a job and to a decent work was one of those clients in the Millennium Program. I believe that program is supposed to be realized by 2015. And the UN Secretary General has called an emergency summit for September 20th and 22nd in New York this year to discuss how to make up for the lost ground in achieving goals of the Millennium Goals. And of course, the employment crisis is one of the major contributors to the failure of the people to keep pace with these goals. The paper surveys the current political discussion around the jobs crisis. It starts off the paper we published, we have caught it in my card over there on our website. Actually, I just was able to print these graphs out as I was leaving work on Wednesday afternoon to get here. So I have been able to print the paper where I actually published it on work and I've moved the label. There's some charts at the end of the table for those of you who don't have them. The first chart is in the introduction of the paper, and it shows the relative length of employment crises and the depth of job loss and the time it took to return to the number of jobs or level of employment prior to the beginning of the crisis. And what you can see is if you agree with Cox and others that the neoliberal program of the assault on the working standards started around the late 70s, that the first really long employment crisis was in 1981, which coincided with the 1982 economic crisis. I lived in Beaver County near Aliquippa, the large Great J&L Steelworks employed 15,000 people, and it was one of the first targets of the year because that mill was shut down in 1982. And, that was followed by several others, and if you look now, we're in a recession that is its deepest since the Great Depression, and the one just previous to it lasted for 4 years, and we were only 2 years of recovery of employment before this recession took place. And one of the papers that I quoted here talks about cascading and escalating series of recessions and weakening of the employment crisis. And this is really a result of neoliberal policies. There have been a lot of discussion in other workshops about how these policies have affected different job situations with employment in different industries. But what's going on today in the political scene is that the trading movement is carrying out agitation, demanding that the banks be taxed and the jobs be provided, and that the government do something. And there's the paper also, covers some of these demands and some of the activities taking place. And it also also discusses the Obama administration's response, which is basically, yes, we agree with you, something should be done, and we're going to do something as soon as possible. And then we go to Congress and discusses the tax cutters, whose approach to solving the jobs crisis is to cut taxes. And the deficit hedges, I think that was Corey Stiglitz, who's saying that the problem is a deficit. And we can't spend money to create jobs or stimulate the economy. And later in the paper, there's a discussion of the effect of globalization. David Schweiger, there's a quote from him where he talks about the effect of globalization on Keynesian stimulation efforts, and the fact that due to the globalization of the production line, that efforts to stimulate jobs with, say, buying windmills or whatever, the overall effect per dollar spent is really undermined by the globalization of production. That you may buy windmills, but they might not be bought in the United States. And there's an excerpt from a speech by Leo Girard, President of the USW, lambasting Congress for buying windmills from China. This is one example of the problem that globalization presents for those in the trading movement and the Democratic Party who believe that we can return to Keynesian policies of borrowing money to stimulate the economy. And the one of the things that I'm advocating in the paper is that we look at the industrial policies of European countries and China as well, where they are imposing some plan for their economy, and instead of, as we're doing, allowing market chaos to determine our economic policy. And planning in these countries is that there's a certain amount of domestic production that's required for any kind of purchases or stimulus money being spent. For example, windmills would have to have so many parts produced in the United States, or so much percentage of steel would have to be produced in the United States. And this is how China and Germany, as I pointed out in this paper, are protecting their domestic workers, but at the same time using the global marketplace. So an industrial policy is really a critical part of foreign policy. The main point of this paper, though, is the concept of employer of last resort, which is the acronym is ELR. And this is a program that is really advocated by L. Randall Ray and Hyman Hennessy. And I use a paper that Ray published, that's published by the ILO. And the Employer Last Resort Program is basically a government hiring program at minimum wage for anybody who is able and willing to work and cannot find a job in the private economy. And it shows that when you account for federal taxes that these workers are going to pay, and the savings in unemployment compensation, food stamps, four of social programs we're currently have in place for people who are sitting idle, that the cost of putting up to 8 billion to 13 million people to work is actually about half a percent of our gross domestic product. And of course, the ELR program is there's a ELR program in Argentina, and there's one in India, Maharashtra State. And these have been pretty successful. And the pro program would be administered locally. And, you know, people will think, what kind of job? I was on the New Brighton Board of Sports and Recreation. And, you know, 10 years ago, we had a program that had playground monitors and people who, you know, maintain playgrounds and ran programs for children, and that's all gone now. I mean, the Board of Parks and Recreation in my town could hire 10 people just like that. And if you look, if you spread that out across the country, you can see that we can hire 5 to 10 million people very quickly. I didn't cite it in my paper, but Ray's paper goes into a lengthy discussion on how this affects aggregate demand, inflation, monetary policies, but just to sum up, you know, what he says, it only affects aggregate demand to the point that everybody's working, and it's a counter-cyclical program. It doesn't substitute for economic stimulus. For example, the economic stimulus packages that was passed that resulted in investment in windmills, high-speed rail, and those kind of things, that would still be there. But the problem is, in our economy, is that we have a special situation as basically a historic holdover from chattel slavery. And that is that people of color in the United States have been relegated to a permanent underclass. And, you know, it's the rate of unemployment in the black community is 3 and 4 times higher than the white community. And these economic stimulus programs, you know, when these high-speed rails built, windmills, for example, African Americans were the last people to be hired. And that money runs out, they're the first people to be hired, fired. So, you know, that is a real important weakness in stimulus approach to create jobs, which doesn't account for this problem of the effects of racism. And, you know, there are approximately 500,000 African American men in jobs, and there are approximately 600,000 jobs. So, I mean, that's something that really has to be addressed. And I think that we have to look at the EOR program as a very important aspect of the program that undercuts, you know, this discriminatory effect on these people of color. The other thing that I survey quite a bit in the paper is the industrial policy proposals of different progressive, some union-affiliated and some not, groups in the United States. There's the Chicago Political Economy Group, and there's the Perry, the Center for Economic Policy and Research. So that there are several groups that have put forward really great programs and suggestions for industrial policy. And one of the criticisms I have of these is they pretty much just, they talk like things are so bad that everybody's going to get together and do something about it. It's just obvious we need, you know, to create jobs. We need to build high speed rail to do this. But so they don't really take into consideration the fact that finance capital has a very conscious program for us, and it does include design for building an industrial jobs or the other major thing that I address is here, I think it's really critical, is the financial transaction tax, also known as the Tobin tax, and I guess in Canada and England they call it the Robinhood tax. And basically there's a small tax from financial transactions made by large players. And it was like $8 billion a year in the United States. And of course, this would have to be, and this is being discussed in different countries, in England, France, Germany, and other by agreement because financial transactions help people pretty easily. But it's a really important way to address several issues. One is funding for industrial policy, and the other is the enormous size and influence of finance capital and the way it's taken over our political process and pretty much undermined industrial production. I have a section on global unemployment, which is 212 million people as of 2009, unemployed globally, an increase of 35 million last year, the highest level of unemployment since the UN, the ILO, and the 18 numbers. So this is a global crisis. The UN ILO passed a jobs pact that was agreed in 2009 as kind of a supplement to the Millennium Goals because they recognized that the deepest crisis globally, the deepest human rights crisis globally is the right to a job. Don't have it for the minimum wage is zero. And your ability to have the access or the ability to exercise any other human rights are greatly reduced without a job. So the Global Jobs Pact of 2009 was designed to address this. And the ILO is meeting this summer to discuss how progress is Jobs Act. There hasn't been any progress in the United States, it's pretty clear. So I think that the issue for the left and the progressives is to raise this issue of full employment policy. And the last thing I want to say is that in the beginning of 1982, when the steel mills were shut down in Alabama, we were involved in the agitation for a jobs bill, which was introduced by Charles Hayes of Chicago. It was petitioned by the Reynolds Steel Mills in Chicago. And this bill was designed to implement the office of the board. So I think that the important thing for us to look at now is agitating and organizing around a new job bill that should be called the Full Employment Act, based on Hayes' bill, and incorporating some of the new ideas, the ELR and financial transaction and industrial policy, so that we do have industrial jobs in the United States. Well, I think I'll leave it at that and just have some questions. Thanks.
Thank you, Randy. We started off with the questions out because in the political work that we did in Western Pennsylvania, whenever the candidates advanced, people would come through. We tried to keep them. Whether it was Obama or whether it was Bill Apple who was running for governor. And they would have their message that we would tell them, look, if you want to get the pensions from the working class around here, you have to make jobs, new jobs, whatever kind of jobs you want to talk about. Point number one. Otherwise, you're not going to get very far. So that's why we had opportunity today. What I want to do is talk very concretely, not so much about Beaver County, although I could go on quite a bit about that, but I want to use a case that's in the news and it's going to be resolved Tuesday to talk about what the situation is in terms of working class politics in the country right now. And that's the race that's going on in Arkansas. might seem odd for a, you know, a kind of out of the way state like Arkansas to be the center of national attention. But there's some very interesting things going on there that serve much broader lessons and are pregnant with possibilities for the rest of the country. There are two Democrats in a special runoff, Arter and Lance Lincoln. They had the primary. There was a third guy that named Stacey at the point. Arter, 43, and then the other guy got 10. He was a businessman. He was part of the spread in the Democratic Party. So you can see the forces were within the Democratic Party were relatively evenly divided between these two.
It's Harlow Taylor.
No, I think it's Harlow. Let me double check here to make sure. Halter. Both on. Halter. Some of you may have heard about it because Bill Clinton went down to give a speech and basically to support Lincoln and then attacked Carter, Halter, as an outside agitator, basically. Kind of a type of almost red
tape.
The interesting thing about him is that Halter is a former one-term lieutenant governor. Former official in the Clinton administration. He worked in the Social Security Department. And basically has a fairly progressive platform. Lance Lincoln, when she was in the Congress, she was one of the founders of the Blue Dog Caucus. And most people recognize her name apart from Ms. Briggs, because she was the deciding vote that stopped the public option on healthcare, that made sure that that more progressive aspect of the insurance reform legislation passed Congress was defeated. She was the one who did the coup de grace, which is one of the reasons why the progressive sector of the electorate in Arkansas wanted to defeat her. They had been giving her money for years. Backing her. And on all the key questions, whether it was the public option, whether it was the Employee Free Choice Act, or any a number of other things that they, the appointment of Becker to the Labor Department, every single one of these things she had turned on. And they were fed up with it. Also, the NAACP, previously she had gotten up to 98% of the black vote. Now, the head of the NAACP in Arkansas was claiming that when it came down to funding for historically black colleges, she had said no. When it come to talking about voting for the hiring of any new black representatives in the judiciary, no. And most important, he also said he rated her an F because of her stand on health care. Because the ones who needed health care, things like the public option, and some of the things that were cut out of insurance, the ones who needed them most were the poorest in Arkansas, which were largely black. So the black vote is beginning to shift away from it. So the interesting thing that's happening is Halter is running against Wall Street. He's making Wall Street his main partner, finance capital. He is basically saying that the rest of America won a big victory with the Obama's election, but now Wall Street is trying to gut it and destroy it. So that's his main campaign point. The main emphasis he's working on are people in their 60 to 75 years old.
That's the main, and he's actually feeling everybody, but the most emphasis he's putting on is this demographic. And he's using his experience in working in Social Security and pointing out Lincoln's threats, his dad's effort, quoting that cutbacks have to be made in Social Security and Medicaid. It's actually smart for another reason. Remember, especially in a by-election, who the average voter is. The average voter in a by-election is an 80-year-old retired working class housewife living out somewhere in Kansas. That's the average voter in the off years. So he's very targeted in that sense, although he is spending the AFL-CIO has come into this in a big way. Their local unions are giving an incredible amount of energy, foot leather, telephone calls, phone banks, and so on. The national CIO can't give you people so much directly, but they've set up independent operations. They've already spent over $3 million doing television ads against. So really, what's most fascinating about this is it represents the difference. What's happening in the Democratic Party. Over here, you have the AFL-CIO lined up with the NAACP and the Sierra Club. They're also in on this. Against Clinton, DLC, and by implication, Obama. I'm still up in the air, which way Obama's going to go, but clearly, that's the battle. And they're saying that these guys are Wall Street. It's fairly accurate. So it's a popular front against finance capital. And that's the form that the class struggle is taking within the Democratic Party itself in the Arkansas election. That's the lineup for it. Like I said, Gwen Swinton, she is running against government. She's a deficit pop. So she's making her main pitch. She's against government. She's against big government. She wants cutbacks in spending. And that's the message. Fiscal conservative deficit talks. Now here's where it gets kind of interesting. Boozman is the Republican. He is a just a diehard neoliberal, markets all good, stay all bad. But what he has been doing is going around Arkansas to every local meeting of the Tea Party. And even though, so what you got basically here on the Republican side is an alliance between your standard Republican neoliberals and the Tea Party. The Tea Party people are upset with him because he voted for the bank. But he comes back and says, well, the banks have paid all their money back. The TARP is already, the TARP funds, the banks already paid their money back. But then he goes off to rant and rail against the other kind of bailouts, GM, and the other things that are more directly beneficial to working. And he goes off to rant and rail and uses that to appeal. He also views the Tea Party on the basis of his gun record, his military connections, opposition to women's reproductive rights, all of these things. Traditional far-right, you know, issues make up his alliance. Now here's where it gets interesting. In all the polls that have taken so far, if it's Harder versus Boozman, the great song about 45-55 in favor of the Republican by the 10-point spread. If it's Lincoln versus Bozeman, it's about 40-60. So the Republicans got the upper hand in either case, but the stronger candidate against the neoliberal far-right alliance is Halter. And the weaker one is Lincoln. The weaker one is Warner. Doesn't sound the same. Now, I'm from Chicago. I've seen this story before. And I understand that one of the people behind this is Rahm Emanuel. It's got him written all over it. I was in two different battles in Chicago where Rahm Emanuel, we had a very progressive candidate trying to take Henry Hyde's overseas. She had got up as much as 40% of the vote. She was the strongest candidate. And he came in at the last minute and put Tammy Duckworth up. She was an Iraq vet who lost both legs. She was a decent person, but she had no independent base. But he had her run against the progressive. And it ended up that the Republican won the election. This is a boy genius. He did this twice, not only the Duckworth Sedalis case, but also in one of the others. His intervention on the same model came in and basically turned the election over to the Republicans. The sort of line that this represents is unite the center, concede to the right, attack and isolate, and defeat the left. So that's what Emanuel's line has been. And we know it very well. We used to sit in and demonstrate outside of his office all the time in Chicago. But now it's getting writ large in national politics. So that's why, like I said, pregnant with possibilities. It's got all these different lessons in it. I think the lesson for us is, apart from the fact that we have to oppose this position and strengthen this position within the Democratic Party. This is the real alliance for the progressive majority. This is also the one that's the most practical in terms of being able to defeat the party. So not only do we have to do that, because it's also where our closest allies are, we want to be able to work with our closest allies. We also have a special role to play within it. Neither of these people oppose war. So there is a vote for the left to not only support them, but also to push them. And that's not going to happen without our being organized within this independent. It's not just a question of us only failing behind the Democratic Party. We have independent vote to play as well. This is what I think is going to be played out in the fall all over the place. So that's why I think this race is so interesting and something we need to pay attention to. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Pat. Are you still
with me? Thank you, Carl. Good afternoon, everybody.
Good afternoon.
My name is Pat Fry, and some of you weren't here in the opening. I'm the committee's correspondent and national co-chair, Carl. I prepared some written remarks, so if you'll bear with me, I'll help you focus on what I want to talk about, much of which has been elaborated already through what Randy and Carl have said. But my remarks are directed more theoretically at strategy, the overall strategy for advancing the class struggle today, and the role of the labor movement, the alliance, key social movements, as Carl described, and the role of the left. I speak to you as a lifelong trade unionist, a peace and justice activist, and since 1970 as someone who has actively been helping to build the communist and socialist left through a number of zigs and zags, I may add. Nevertheless, since the founding of the Community Correspondents in the early 90s, that's what I devoted my work to. The starting point for any discussion of strategy is getting clear what we are dealing with. And I think I'm probably talking to the choir here. But we had an interesting back and forth on the internet that our membership listserv the other day in response to the big strikes in France around defending pensions, you probably heard about. And Jim Campbell from our leadership made the point that from the beginning of capitalist development, when the commons became enclosed, and until this moment in human history, it has been a life and death struggle between the workers and the surplus value created created socially by the working class. And on the other hand, those who have organized to take more and more is socially created wealth for themselves. This is the essence of the current global financial crisis, compounded by the shrinking need for physical labor in modern production. Nothing but the power of the working class to organize in opposition will stand in the way of capitalist drive for ever increasing profit. Our schools, our health care, oil drenching our shores, our social security and pensions, our health and well-being, all is gained for the capitalists to take. This is the principal challenge before the left and the progressive movement. We need to do a better job of coming to grips with it and explaining it. Only a socialist system of public ownership and democratic control of the main levers of the economy can provide the basis for a sustainable future for the planet and reverse the startling inequalities in this country and the world. The question before us is what has been the question throughout the last century, so what is to be done? And how do we resolve this basic contradiction of capitalist society and construct a socialist future? And what is the winning strategy between it? We in the Committee for Correspondence offer for discussion in our goals and principles document that we developed and issued just this past year that the path to democracy and socialism is the work of advancing democratic reforms, some small, some qualitatively significant, working on issues arising from the daily crises of everyday living that can be linked to a coherent progressive platform. Coalitions of organizations will be established around a common program, and it is in the first place a strategy of building a progressive majority on the need to build the broadest unity to win concrete gains and to defeat the aggressive right wing. It is the basis for dialogue, for joint action, and long-term cooperation between the center and the left. History shows us what it takes to win significant and indispensable democratic reforms, from the fight for industrial unionization and the struggle to break Jim Crow segregation. The core forces of labor and the African American people and women forged an unbreakable unity that led to these historic democratic advances. Today, that same alliance includes Blacks, Latinos, Asians, Native Americans, immigrant peoples, women, youth, and those discriminated against on the basis of sexual preference. Where is the labor movement today in rebuilding that historic alliance? And there's good news to report, as Carl already talked about. Significant developments not seen since the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s are in the making. It was in full motion and tested in the stunning victory of Barack Obama in the role played by labor in particular. The leadership of the now head of the AFL-CIO, President Richard Trumka, in taking on racism in the ranks of union membership. The enormous get out the vote effort of labor that involved thousands of trade unionists played a critical role in this watershed victory. It was within this electoral struggle on the issue of racism that the basis for unity so necessary for winning a coalition was cemented. Unity cannot be built without trust, and the trade union leadership rose to the occasion in this historic election. So since that election, coalition building has flourished, starting with the Great healthcare reform battle in Congress. The coalition that led the fight, UFL-CIO and Exchange to Win Unions, the NAACP, La Raza, Immigrant Rights Organizations, Women, Seniors, Community, Religious Organizations, and Youth. It was a struggle and victory over a racist, anti-communist, and well-funded right wing to win the Affordable Care Act. That win, as short as it was in the goal of single payer, opened up new paths of struggle, provided the necessary morale and fighting spirit that has extended to other reform struggles today. And in those three main areas right now that we see these coalitions, whether on Wall Street, banking reforms, the demand for jobs and new green industries, and immigration reform. Last January, there was an emergency meeting of all these organizations there on this coalition that was convened, and the AFL-CIO emerged out of that with a five-point program for jobs. Most recently, we have seen that coalition lead protests on Wall Street and around the country. Hundreds of thousands have been in the streets around Arizona law. And in New York, we've seen in the last 3 weeks, 109 leaders of this coalition have been arrested in civil disobedience at the federal building in New York. A large May Day rally was held in New York. There was a significant number of labor leaders representing the highest ranks of the AFL-CIO, and many elected leaders that participated, as well as community religious organizations. And the rally was organized by a core of progressive trade unions in New York, and it really was the first time there was such a Labor Day rally on May Day since the Cold War. And I think we can finally say that Cold War anti-communism is no longer a sure thing as a tool of division today. The healthcare victory over the right has propelled the labor movement and its allies in the direction of political independence in the Democratic Party machine. And the Arkansas primary is an example. Another good example is Arlen Specter's defeat in Pennsylvania. And in both cases, the trade union movement and allied forces led that fight. I think also that in Clinton's speech in Arkansas, I think he directly attacked the trade union movement and the coalition. It was quite startling, actually, because so much of that movement had support in him and other campaigns. What we've seen is a growing independence, and it's also seen in the sharp criticism of the Obama administration lately by the trade union movement around Arizona, around the deployment of National Guard troops to the border. I have been and still am a political director of the SEIU level, and I see firsthand the very impressive political mobilization of the membership. A member-based internal organizing model has been built over the last, since the 2006 elections. And some of the main features of that mobilization is the member political MPO program, member political organizers that are recruited out of the shops and workplaces, and they are trained as cadre to lead, to get out the vote campaigns, to lobby in Congress and in state houses and raise political action money. SEIU is not the only union that's doing this. There's a number of unions that are putting into motion this very, at the base of membership organizing. There's rapid response alerts and actions like letter writing, online petitioning involving a greater number of union members, and members are being recruited to running races in the electoral campaigns. They're being trained to be candidates. Recently, the SEIU has been organizing to send these member political organizers to Montgomery, Alabama, to observe firsthand the site of the Montgomery bus boycott as a way to learn grassroots organizing the civil rights movement. This is a very important development. So the preparing for the November election, the Coalition of Labor Unions and Rights Organizations and others are making plans for a mass mobilization in Washington on October 10th. That's going to involve AFL-CIO, all the Change to Win unions, the NAACP, and the rights organizations, and it's meant to be a, for the November elections, a campaign that will target the Tea Party and will be part of the mobilization to get out the vote. It hasn't been announced publicly yet, but it should be fairly soon. There's organizing meetings going on to build before it's announced. AFSCME will be spending $50 million on federal and state election midterm elections. That's an increase of 67% over the 2006 midterm elections. SEIU is earmarked $44 million, up 33%, and Emily's list plans on spending $43 million. These are all important new developments in the working class movement, and taken together represent qualitative advance in unity and the interconnected issues of the class. So lastly, I want to just end on a note on the role of the left. Karl Marx's astute observation that labor in the white skin cannot be free until labor in the black skin is free remains as true today as it was in the 19th century. The crisis of unemployment, now officially at almost 15%, has been the condition in cities like Detroit and Cleveland beginning in the 1970s, when the full-scale attack by capital on labor began. It was followed by the war on drugs, used as a cover to brutalize the black and Latino neighborhoods, mass imprisonment, destruction of public education and housing. The labor movement was weak and unable to respond to the wholesale destruction of our central cities. The fight to stop NAFTA was compromised by a nativist Buy American campaign and the rabid racism that blamed the Japanese people rather than U.S. corporations for the loss of jobs. I recall very vividly as a person who's from Detroit, the murder of Benson Chin by white auto workers, baseball fans. In this environment, by the 1985, an important struggle developed for legislation introduced by Congressman Charles Hayes and John Conyers, which Randy referred to earlier. It's interesting, both African-American congressmen, one from Chicago, propelled by the loss of steel, and John Conyers in Detroit by the loss of auto jobs. That bill was introduced in 1985 and called the Income and Jobs Action Act. It had 66 co-sponsors in Congress, and there were hearings that were held, one of which was in Alabama. The left played an important role in advancing that struggle. Members of the Communist Party and other left organizations helped to build support for this legislation in homes and neighborhoods. Also in this period, the left was instrumental in seeding the idea of a national trade union conference that took place on plant closings. And organizing was key to the winning. What came out of that was the Warren Act, which provided a 90-day advance notice of plant closings. Not what we really wanted and needed, but it did provide that partial reform that was used recently effectively by the union of public workers, window workers in Chicago. And that drew national attention to the role of banks and hedge funds in destroying the lives of workers in our communities. So now in 2010, there are calls mainly from left circles now for legislation for jobs and income now. The Hayes-Conyers Bill of 1985 built on earlier employment efforts, as Randy's talked about, the Hawkins Bill, which, by the way, was a household name in the 1970s, some of you might remember. That bill drew on earlier efforts of FDR's Second Bill of Rights. And so there is quite a continuity here from the New Deal, the FDR, to I think similar legislation today. think over the last 20, 25 years, or since at least the late 90s, the left has been on the ropes in this country. It has been weak since the Cold War, certainly, but got even weaker with the collapse of the socialist country. And I think now is the time to rebuild the left, to regroup, and to play a more active role in strategy and helping to advance both the day-to-day struggles and the content of the coalition work I've described here. An all-important issue that remains taboo in the ranks of labor is the linking of the military budget and the U.S. foreign policy to restore jobs, education, housing, healthcare, and the environment. The so-called defense budget is off limits for discussion and this really has to change. New energy is forming at the grassroots in support of the Democracy Charter, spearheaded by a veteran of the veteran strategist of the civil rights movement, Jack Fidel, and now enshrined in a book, which I have over here, called Climbing Jacob's Ladder. I urge all of you who are interested in advancing the democratic struggle in this country to read it. It is quite an important tool, I think, for advancing our struggle and for building the grassroots coalition at the base, connecting the issues of democracy that were framed in FDR's Second Bill of Rights to today. So the left must play an important role through patient grassroots organizing and working with the key forces of the coalition of progressive majority that is emerging to the issue today. Thanks very much for listening.
Campaign in support of Calder, whether this issue of the linking of the military budget can in any way be raised, because as so far as I know, he hasn't taken any. Is there any way of linking that up? Because in a way, the whole point of all this effort is to, as you said, push as well as support.
I searched all as much as I could, talk to people about trying to find some anti-militarism there somewhere to find it. I don't know whether it's because it's Arkansas and they have no military bases there, or keeping their mouths shut or whatever, but again, I think that's where the independent role of that comes in. If by an organization in Arkansas, I would probably be supporting, certainly be supporting Calder, but I'm also be raising the question that we're not be able to get into it. You're not going to be able to get a green manufacturing industrial policy unless you take on the military and oil industrial policy.
You know what I find a curious thing right now in this climate is hearing about, I think it was nice of the teacher organization and UUP and other large teachers groups in New York State, and so forth. They've been passing out of Afghanistan resolutions, and I hear people talking about this. I haven't been there myself. And they say that there is no opposition. In other words, no one gets up at the microphone and offers anything on the other side, and they seem to pass easily by the aid. If the leadership is restive about it, it's more that they don't want to see it implemented through a massive educational campaign, or they try to cut that back a little bit to achieve officers or something. But it's an odd fact to me that in the absence of any anti-war movement right now, that this has been easy, it seems. And so that would be a way to wedge in, is that many, many unions could pass these resolutions. Maybe it's something that is malleable right now and could start to remedy.
I think it's critical. We put that in the Agro-Seattle itself as a decent position. A decent position, certainly on the ground. But I never said whether back in 2006 I got it on the ballot in Chicago and most of Illinois, actually. And is basically an out-and-out from a rock preservation. We got 81%, 19%. We got 800,000 votes for it.
Wow.
That's just one little piece. That's just one tactic, one piece of it. Actually, I mean, now it's a critical controversy question. We really have to make a break the kind of in favor of the kind of full employment, green manufacturing, industrial policy, and you talk about it. And the only way we're going to do that is to make a break with the industrial policy. So the thing is that I think the neoliberals are, in a way, quasi Keynesians, except that they're military Keynesians. Oh, and it's only when it comes to preventing military and controlling that they're in favor of government supports government intervention. Anything else, the people, forget about it.
I want to say something on this. Really an important issue because now is the time to raise the issue of the military budget because of all the losses to transportation, to schools, everybody's getting laid off, and the unions and the public sector are directly affected by it. There's an interesting development in New York. Letitia James on the city council is set to introduce a resolution by the city council calling on New York congressional delegation to introduce in Congress or to support in Congress a bill that's been introduced by Marty Frank to cut the military budget by 25%. And it's going to be the resolution will directly link the issue of jobs in New York and all the loss of social services that are coming down on us to the military budget. And there's going to be an organizing meeting this coming week, actually, a few people to launch a campaign to go to the unions to get them on board to build for some support around Marty Frank bill, but also Letitia James's bill. So we're kind of looking to try to get something off the ground there. Also, another interesting development, the mayor of Binghamton, New York, did a survey of the population of the city around the military budget, and the questions were directed at social services or the military budget, and the Center for National Priorities, I think, have you can go to their website and find out how much the military budget in your community is used, is ripped off for the people there. So that's the statistics that they use. And out of that, he got the city council to endorse such a resolution that I talked about that's coming in New York City. But also, they have built this, I haven't seen it, but it's a sign. It must be like a projection, some kind of projection right outside of City Hall, which graphically shows how many schools or how many teachers we could hire if the military budget, were decreased. Binghamton, New York. Yeah, there's a couple articles on it recently. So some of us in New York have taken on the idea of going to the boroughs, each borough, to the borough president, and urge them to do the same. It's an educational tool, but it's something at the grassroots that we can possibly generate something. There's actually on the website, in the Binghamton City Council website, they have a video discussion of the vote on the city council. Fascinating
the
discussion.
The Huffington Post had a nice headline. Congress goes home without passing an unemployment compensation extension, without funding 300,000 teacher jobs under the acts. Taking out the COBRA aid and failing to pass restitution of Medicaid compensation to doctors at the same time as passing billions of dollars for new spending for Afghanistan. It's a good headline. And I think it's important, in my point of view, I live in a district in Western Pennsylvania, the Blue Dog Congressman, that, you know, the Republicans and the Blue Dog were able to sign this bill so that it's thousands of people as of the June 1st, you know, lost their And the problem is there's nobody to run against the congressman in our district. And he has carte blanche to support these efforts because the even though in our district Labor played a tremendous role in turning the Hillary Clinton supermajority into a 48% vote for Obama by November, by really mobilizing their forces, it's not there the political sophistication to oppose this new government conflict. And that's one of the reasons that in our area we're building a progressive Democrats in America to kind of have a party within a party to build an opposition. And you know, there's a lot of, we do have a large enough number that you know, a lot of meetings and discussions about how to get somebody running against the Democratic primary. That didn't happen. So now everybody's trying to figure out what we're going to do in November. So that'll be the next discussion. But I think across the country, you know, that's really the problem. That's why I'm really encouraged by this thing around Halter. It's got to be just more than taking off a letter.
Thank you. I come from Turkey, and when I listen to you, I really appreciate that your emphasis on defense budget issue and job creation issue. And in Turkey, it is the same. We review each budget for defense expenses, and it really stands as an obstacle in social expenditure. I know the questions I will discuss about the role of the military in nowadays in Turkey, but nobody discussed, you know, to the mainstream media and some public manipulation caused that. Nobody discussed the budgets for defense in Turkey. And another issue, especially is a serious problem among Marxists. I'm also activist in this movement. I also try to have a dialogue with different social movements. They never focus about the importance of the job creation. This is very important. It may be very simple. For many Orthodox Marxists, it may seem so reformist or opportunist, but it's really very important because if you ask people, if you go to local communities, the only problem they talk about is job creation. So your emphasis on job creation is really important. The point I am curious in your presentation, you really have many problems in this coalition building process among different social movements or organizations. And I wonder, in your case, what kind of problems you see, you experience in daily life politics by bringing in different social movements, people from different social movements. This is the first question. I ask maybe the first three obstacle you see while bringing people together. Second one is, what is the role of the religious organizations or churches or religious communities? Because in Turkey, we really have a problem about these communities because it's really an obstacle for many social movements. And it is very difficult to articulate the progressive movement in many countries, these religious institutions. And what is the role of religious organizations in your movement or in your organizations? What is their contribution to someone?
I talk about this in my paper, but I think a really major problem we have is that the neoliberal assault on employment has dramatically affected young people. We were talking the other day at lunch about advising our children to stay in college as long as you can, because there's not, you know, your chances of getting a job when you get out is so much less than they were, you know, a few years ago. And I think that the lack of employment among youth has led to problems with socialization of the job with other generations. So that generation gap, I think, is something that we really are going to have to take special measures consciously address. This is one of the reasons I think that working on a full employment program, the employer of last resort is sort of like the public option of health care. It's the public option. If you can't get a job, the government has a public option for employment. That's so, especially young people, will have some way of bridging that gap. But I think that's a major problem. In the work we're doing in Western Pennsylvania around health care for the last 5 years, the question always comes, where are the young people? Why can't we get them involved? It's because there's a lack of social contact because of the deep unemployment. And of course, in our county, there's been a mass exodus of the young population to other parts of the country.
On the issue of how these different coalition partners are working together, it's a very good question. I did a lot of the door-to-door work, for the Obama campaign through my SEIU. And, Uber and during the primary, door-to-door for Obama with Hillary Clinton. And it was like the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s. Knocking on those doors, it wasn't because they were. It was an experience. And I was not in the South during the civil rights movement. I read about it. I have always been in the struggle to defeat racism on college campuses in the 60s. But this was really, and I cannot stress enough the importance of that work in showing the African American community that the trade union movement can be counted on, right? And the trade union, of course, is black and white, Latino. But the fact that the trade union leadership at the highest ranks took on this issue and went full square in support of Obama in opposition to the DLC was, to me, the bedrock of building something more going forward. And that's why I see so importantly these coalitions. Now, these coalitions are at the national level, right? So a lot needs to be done at the grassroots to build. But the Sierra Club, the environmental movement, the movement around jobs are working. SEIU has been going out and reaching out to the African American churches in many communities around the country to build the Green Jobs Movement. They've been doing that for a couple of years now, but they have been going to the African American churches mainly because these are the communities hardest hit. And so the churches, are playing a role in that movement as well as the immigrant rights movement. A number of the religious leaders, a number of people that were arrested last week. Not only were religious leaders, but they were the African American community. It was interesting the way they did it. It was 3 weeks in a row that they had these protests, civil disobedience at the Federal Plaza. And the first week, the immigrant rights organization took the lead in organizing it. The second week, it was the African American organizations, civil rights organizations, and the African American churches and the Caribbean, Afro-Caribbean churches that convened the organizing for that Monday and took the lead in being arrested. So this is, a concrete example of that, working together and bringing together issues, because black people have, contrary to the media says that jobs are being taken away from us because these immigrants are coming. It's absolutely not true. And But it is in the forging of these coalitions that the unity builds.
Yeah, we had some, as a result of the fiscal crisis, we have our hospital now open, which was a gift to the city government from Steel Workers Union. Been around for quite some time. And so a fairly good community hospital, but it had been closed. It was bought up by a for-profit outfit that gutted it. And then all of a sudden, all work, the remaining workers and nurses got themselves out on the street, not even their pay, when they were paid. And SEIU let us sit in, along with the SEIU, the SEIU promised to sit in the hospital to try to get the workers a nice flavor, Catholic priest. So we had the Catholics there. Every time we had these mobilizations outside of our Blue Dog Congressman's office, most bulletin speeches always come from Catholic nuns. They are great people to have on your side, believe me. I think it's something that you have to think about flexibly, because on other issues, the Catholic Church is supposed to rights and things like that. But even, you know, the right wing, we all know about right wing Christians and right wing evangelicals and how they take an advantage and try to build your favorite person to the right. But even there, I think you have to look concretely. I have an evangelical Baptist church, all white, for a community out where I live. They're all right believers. But every first Saturday of every month, there's 100 pickup trucks in their lot. They are the distributors of free food for very hungry old people who are stuck in their trailers and hollows. All these old pickups come out and come out everywhere. They load up with food for people who are hungry. So I talked to the youth group of this church when they were we got together after they were distributing the food. One day, and they were all for a while. And they were putting the pressure on my neighbor, who's a minister, to finally come out for a while. And he eventually he did. His older parishioners didn't pay that much attention, but he responded to the young, which was kind of reflected in a way the demographics of where we were, because we went 48% for Obama. And this is in Western Pennsylvania, very, where all the shit in the van when Obama and the right workers and all that whole battle together. That was prime zero for it. And, but among the younger workers, it went 2-1 for Obama. So there's a generational question there. And sometimes things are not always too conventional. Sometimes you go a little deeper and you can find allies where you might not. The churches are important because the things we're up against is this famous book was written recently called Lowell Being Alone. One of the things neoliberalism has done is atomize the working class, break it down in any sense of organization and community. Everybody's so isolated from each other. And the churches are one of the few forms of organization that still exist that bring working class people together, where they actually come and meet face-to-face. Especially important in the Black community. Not much left except churches and the gangs. Some of the sports teams that exist in Black community, that's probably the third. But among the white working class, the churches, the open alleys, those are some, the few places that people come together. Among the younger kids, it's the big Kendrick group around their bands. These are the few places where people come together and that we have to work with. So the churches are extremely important, I think. And they have a left, a middle, and a right. But but we have to deal with all of them as best we can, because we have to work wherever the working people are when they come together. And so I think that's where we need to at least don't automatically dismiss people. I think about, I'm going to blame the victim a little bit. I guess one of the property opposite to the left itself. I was like to tell left-wing audiences that I talk to that each of you needs to know and have the skills of the average Chicago Daily Machine precinct worker. The average Daily Machine precinct worker has 10 blocks in his precinct. He knows every person. Knows their families. Knows who's registered to vote. He knows who's not registered to vote. He knows who's about to be 18 to be registered to vote. He knows where they stand. He has them categorized plus, minus, and zero. He knows all of this stuff. And they all know him. He comes around, asks them what their problems are. If your garbage getting picked up properly, is your mother getting put in the nursing home? That's what your average Chicago precinct captain knows. How many left people do you know that know the same amount about their block? You should at least try to rise to the level of your average Chicago precinct captain if you want to be able to win strikes and elections. So anyway, that's down the grassroots. And then you have to have your own organization. I'm not saying you should, you know, become a Democratic Party precinct candidate. You organize a PBA, you have your own budget, your own bank accounts, your own list that belong to you. You might vote for Democrats or whatever, but have your own organization that belongs to you that at least has the same level of skill as your average Chicago precinct candidate. We'd be a hell of a lot better off.